From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When he was a columnist at the New York Times, Jonathan Reynolds often wrote about the powerful emotional connection people have with food. Now he has tracked his own culinary life story using recipes as milestones. He's called his book Wrestling with Gravy, A Life with Food. And although it's mostly a memoir, it's also in part a cookbook. Random House is the publisher, and I'm very pleased it has brought Jonathan Reynolds back to my show today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
I'm well. The last time we were here, we weren't talking about food at all. Stonewall Jackson's house.
Yes, yes. I was wearing a different hat then.
Well, you've been a writer of different sorts, a playwright, screenwriter, everything but a cooking professional, as far as I can tell. And yet, food has been a major part of your
always,
career.
Yes. It's always been. I mean, it's a major part of everybody's life, whether they know it or not. I mean, whether they can focus on it. But
yeah, but some people, for some people, it matters a lot. And for some people, it's... Well, it's what I do to stay alive and nothing more.
Yes, right.
And you credit the dish pheasant under glass with your culinary awakening. I think I remember eating pheasant once. It was about the driest thing I ever ate. Was it a great pheasant under glass?
Well, part of any food experience is the experience that surrounds the food as well as the food itself. I was 13 or 14, I think, and I had this wonderful uncle who was really a surrogate father. His name was Frank Remick, and he was actually Lee Remick was my first cousin. And he used to help out with being a father. He lived in Boston. He'd come down to New York and occasionally take me out to dinner. And this one time he took me to, the Westbury Hotel. And I looked at the menu, and there was pheasant under glass, which I'd heard about all these years as being the ritziest thing that one could order. And I'd never had it. And I thought, oh, he's going to say, no, that's far too expensive. But I said, what about that? And he said... Absolutely. That I had them put it on the menu just for you. So I ordered it, and it arrived, and it didn't look all that wonderful. It was sort of beige. And I lifted up the waiter lifted up the glass dome on it, and these vapors came out, and I sort of recoiled from them. And my uncle very nicely leaned forward and waved the vapors towards his nose, and he said, this is the point. It's the aroma. And he was such a charming man, and the experience was so wonderful. Even though I wasn't that crazy about the pheasant, I thought, oh, this is an extraordinary experience, and food can really be an art form.
And he gave you little hints as to other things, gently chastised you about wanting to put ketchup on your
ketchup
steak.
On good meat, mm-hmm. Yes. That was something I've always remembered.
Well, we all eat, but not all of us are lucky enough to have or to recognize landmark meals. You did grow up in nice circumstances.
Yes.
You think it would have been different if you had grown up poor?
In terms of food, you mean?
Yeah.
Or certainly my life would have been a whole lot different if I'd grown up poorer. Yeah, I was a privileged Upper East Side kid in Manhattan and went to private schools here. And I can't say that the food was wonderful, though, at those private schools. Or my mother, my parents were divorced when I was very young, and my mother was a cook, but not a very good one. And it took quite some years before... the pheasant under glass experience was one, but then when I graduated from college, my father bought me a first-class ticket on the SS France, which was then the premier ship of the world, as far as I knew. And
people talked about the great food.
Yes, and it was stunning, and it was in those days you had to dress. I was 22; I was just out of college, and I didn't know a tuxedo from Levi's and a T-shirt. But we had to put tuxedos on to go to dinner. And I would go every night to dinner and literally stuff myself. It was a 5 or 6 day crossing, and I think I put on 10 or 12 pounds and just couldn't believe the extraordinary things that could be done with food.
But in contrast to that, one of the landmark meals you have that that includes a recipe is Monterey County Jail oatmeal.
Thank you for bringing that up. Yes, I hope the FBI is not listening. But yes, I was arrested with a friend of mine, totally of my own provocation, for trespassing on Kim Novak's property. This was, I should have known better. I was now out of college. 4 years after the SS France experience. But we were, a friend and I were doing a cross-country trip as, you know, seniors in college, and I'd always had this enormous and completely idiotic crush on Kim Novak since my early days as a, since 12 or 13. And someone had said we were getting a burger, and somebody said, you know, Kim just happened to drop that Kim Novak lives up there in the Carmel Highlands. And I said, my God, she does. We've got to go see her. She'll remember me from some letters I wrote her as a 13-year-old, which is also preposterous. And we went up there and did find her address. And there were two houses next to each other, and I wasn't sure which one was hers. But as I was heading for her house, another, a car pulled in after us, and it was a very elderly woman who immediately called the police. We were arrested. The police were not amused by my infatuation for Kim Novak, and we spent the night in jail. And in the morning, had Monterey County oatmeal and some powdered scrambled eggs.
So you had this volatile life. On the one hand, privileged. On the other hand, boarding schools.
Yes.
And then jail.
Right.
Well, and I don't know whether the boarding schools. I know boarding schools are not known for gastronomic experiences, and often people don't learn good table manners either, because I know somebody who went to boarding school and ate with his elbows on the table with one hand around his plate because he was always protecting it from, I guess, somebody else stealing some of his food.
Oh, really? Oh. Well, I still wonder about what the proper etiquette is if you have peas or something else elusive on the plate. Can you use the bread as a stopper or not? Or is that... Are you just supposed to somehow figure it out with a fork and not use the left hand for any help or your other hand?
So have you watched other people yeah, who have better manners than you?
I never see them doing that, but I had a little conversation with Letitia Baldridge, and I said, answer this for me because I never learned this. And she said, it's perfectly all right to pick up a piece of bread or a roll or anything like that and use it as a stopper. And I said, what about a knife? She said, that's not so good. but a piece of bread is apparently okay.
But you, then you shouldn't mop up the sauce with your
bread.
No,
that's okay too. And it's okay, fine, if you've got a great bone to pick it up and gnaw on it like a prime rib or something. That's completely acceptable.
Although you've done a lot of acting in your career, you've been primarily a writer. Considering this book, isn't it ironic that the first short story you wrote in college was about an eating contest?
Yes. How did you know that? My goodness. Yeah, that's yes, it was about an eating contest, and it was in the literary magazine there. And,
so you've always been thinking about food.
Always. It's always been on my mind. I've always found it amusing and so enjoyable.
Why do you think it is so important to some people who associate it with all sorts of positive things? I mean, everything from just sensory delights to sex and love and whatever else. And then other people just don't get it.
Well, I think it's a I'll tell you what, I have a friend who does not like having dinner because as a child, he grew up and his parents argued all the time over dinner. And he really doesn't. He may, you know, run off in the middle of the night and sneak burgers or something, and that may satisfy him. But he really doesn't like to sit down to dinner with me or with anybody else. And I think there are emotional connections with it. But I don't know about the development of the taste bud. I'm not enough of a scientist to know. I know that everyone likes the food that they had in their childhood, whether you're from Mexico or New Delhi or New York or whatever. It's always when you're older that that's what you return to. That's what gives you comfort.
Well, almost everyone. My mother was a really bad cook.
Well, yes, there's nothing from your childhood that you like?
I'll try to think. Yeah, things I had from my childhood that weren't necessarily cooked in the house. Uh-huh. A good pastrami sandwich, something like that.
Usually but, soft, right? That's what comfort food is. Yeah. Usually soft. Yes. Not always, but no.
But no, nothing that I can remember. Or if I like it, it's because it's cooked differently.
Well, how is it that you grew up then liking food so much if you didn't like it as a child?
I don't know. In my case, my mother was working and she'd call home and ask, I was the eldest, asked me to put something up. And I said, well, what do I have to do? And she'd give me some basic instructions. And knowing what I knew about her cooking, I think, well, you know, actually, it might be interesting if I added this or I did something else, which then led to my doing a lot of the cooking in the house, but also led me to becoming more and more adventurous.
Really? So you grew up as a cook? I mean, you were...
Well, not as a cook.
But I mean, cooking.
Yeah, just as the eldest until others started helping. But I started developing a taste for other things. And I am sad that it took so long for me to really eat a good meal. Your pheasant under glass was when you were a teenager. I think I probably had my first really good meal when I was in my 20s.
Well, when I think back about my culinary life, I sort of dated from that trip on the France more than the experience with my uncle at the Westbury. Certainly had to do with food because that was the center of it, but it also had to do with a really strong emotional experience and my attachment for him, which was considerable, and that was sort of the highlight of it in a way, or when I realized that this was a man I could really count on, whereas I couldn't count on my father at all. So... but that was certainly tied in with food. But, I wonder, they've done studies about music which say that the music that you particularly like, isn't it in your late teens or early 20s, that's sort of what stays with you for the rest of your life? Am I wrong about that? I'm not sure that I'm right. But
well, I'm sure it's true.
I think you arrive at food things around that time, too. Probably you and I both did around then.
My guest is Jonathan Reynolds. His book, Wrestling with Gravy, A Life with Food, is published by Random House. So you've done a lot of different writing. You have written...
A real dilettante, yes.
You've written film scripts, some of them actually made, unlike...
I've had five made, which...
that's pretty good.
Well, it is, except none of them made a dime, but other than that, they were... It was hot for a while.
Well, there were some good movies, weren't there?
Well, Mickey and Maude I thought was pretty good. Actually, I thought that was quite good. Blake Edwards directed that, and Dudley Moore was in it, the wonderful Dudley Moore.
And then how did you wind up writing about food for a living?
Well, I had returned to New York, was on the verge of a divorce. I'd been living in California and had been working in the movies and had written a number of plays which had been done in New York. And Frank Rich was a friend of mine, and he called one day and said that the magazine, he'd been over to dinner a bunch of times, and 10 or 15 years ago, and he called and he said the magazine wants to go in a different direction with its food column at Sunday Magazine. Would you be interested? And I said, now, Frank, I don't really write prose. I mean, I did, but I didn't realize it in letter form and things like that. But he said, why don't you give it a try? And I said, nah, I don't. He said, just try it, you know. Stop being dumb and just try it. So I wrote one column called Alice Waters Cooks Her Turkey Too Long. And they liked it at the Times, and they printed that and said, write one more. And I did. And they said, we'd like you to do this on a regular basis. Would you be interested? And it turned out that it came somewhat easily to me, and I really enjoyed it and tried to make each of the pieces sort of colorful and have some kind of emotional contact or personal contact, not emotional necessarily, but personal.
Well, how did you come to the conclusion that Alice Waters cooks her turkey too long? She is one of the greatest cooks in the
absolutely.
World.
Absolutely. I adore Alice Waters. And I feel bad about that title, but there was I didn't know her at the time and did know of her, of course. But she had a wonderful recipe for cooking a turkey, but you brine it for a couple of days ahead of time, and which I don't do. I inject it rather than brine it. But nevertheless, that's just a slight aesthetic difference we have. But then she had in the same recipe that the turkey should be in the oven longer than I thought it should be. And
some people believe in cooking it, roasting it on low heat, and some on high heat.
I'm a high heat, very high heat, and baste it a lot and turn it frequently. So I hope it was an amusing disagreement with Alice, I wasn't saying that she's incompetent because that would be ridiculous.
But. Now, all the recipes here are really things that you picked up along the way. In many cases, people shared them with you when you asked them to. Mm-hmm. Did anybody ever say to you, no, that's my family secret, I'm not going to tell you?
There was one Chinese restaurant in New York. I mean, one of my gripes about New York, I think New York is sort of the food capital of the world in many ways, but I think it doesn't have very good Chinese food, and I think it's actually got a bad Chinatown compared to Los Angeles, which I think has quite a good Chinatown, and San Francisco, too.
I'll have to give you some places to go to.
Okay. Well, I've been to a lot, but I'm sure I bow to your expertise. But there was an uptown a Chinese restaurant. I was doing a piece on tofu and trying to make it interesting because I didn't understand tofu. And I thought the Chinese certainly have a knack with it. And they just said, and they made wonderful tofu. And they said, you know what? We're not going to give you this recipe.
Now, this book includes stuff like 10 Rules for Seducing a Woman by Cooking Her Dinner.
Yes.
I'm not going to go into them.
Good.
Another one on how to actually get a woman to accept your proposal for marriage.
Oh, yes.
This is all autobiographical?
Yes.
Now, in the 10 Rules for Seducing a Woman by Cooking Her Dinner, you have the practical, find out if the seductee is allergic to anything.
Yes.
I would think that's true under any circumstance, having somebody over for dinner for any reason. And then you also say you have to pull off at least one impressive cooking flourish. That's important in seducing the woman?
Well, I think it helps. It may not be essential. None of these, I mean, some of this is sort of tongue-in-cheek, but this it does help if you can set something on fire or toss stuff around in a wok, or the way they pour. And it took me quite a long time to learn to do this, and don't ask me to do it now, although I could do it because this is radio. But pouring mint tea from a great height, the way they do in a Moroccan restaurant, which is always dramatic and wonderful and impressive, and it takes a long time to get it so it doesn't splash around or you miss the cup or the.
Well,
so
a number of the recipes include very expensive ingredients, foie gras, yes. Truffles.
Yes.
Now, truffles are incredibly expensive,
yes.
And that's a way to impress people?
Well, I don't think you do it every night. It's sort of, that was the, I suggest that one, that's how you get someone to marry you. That's not just necessarily.
Is it white or black truffles?
This was black, although white, I actually prefer white, but this one was black, wrapped in pastry, and had a little foie gras and a little slice of ham on side. I mean, it was, well, this was, I wanted her to marry me. It was my first wife, and she did.
You're also crazy about chestnuts. And
yes.
There was a time when I was growing up in New York where every corner would have somebody roasting chestnuts. In
Such
Manhattan.
A wonderful smell.
And you hardly see that anymore.
Yeah.
In fact, most of the chestnuts I see come from France. They're imported.
Right.
What happened?
Yeah, well, you can't find them in those corner stands anymore. It's all now pretzels and hot dogs. And
what do you think happened? We just lost our taste for chestnuts?
Well, they are a somewhat rarefied taste, I guess. Although you're right, they were everywhere, and they were quite common. I don't know what's happened to our taste for chestnuts.
You wrote the article at the New York Times for how long?
6 years. I was biweekly, which is every other week, for 5 years, and then monthly for a year. And then went off and have now written a play, which is going to be at the Long Wharf next year, and this book, Wrestling with Gravy. So,
and your wife is a theatrical designer.
Yes.
Heidi Ettinger.
Ettinger,
I'm
right.
Sorry. I've seen the name many times.
Yes.
So theater seems to be the natural place for you to be right now.
I love the theater. I've always loved the theater. It's you can't mass produce it.
Meanwhile, you're still eating out as much as possible, I'm sure.
Yes, all the time.
And Jonathan Reynolds' book, Wrestling with Gravy, A Life with Food, is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.